Committee on Mineral Affairs on the issue of illicit mining. We also have received at this stage, I think, a presentation from the DPCI. So I just want to indicate to members, 9 o'clock on Friday morning. Today's hearing is, well, actually two items. Now, we've got a bit of a time problem in terms of this venue. We have got this venue only until 12:15. So I want members also to cooperate in terms of questions, and also we're going to restrict the presentation to 10 minutes, and we will ask the presenters to be concise and to the point. In terms of the presentations today, we're going to first deal with the issues of the Private Security Sector Provident Fund. In terms of the first quarterly of CIRA, hopefully we will be able to deal with that. If we're not able to deal with that, we will just postpone it to two weeks' time. That's unfortunate, but that's how it is. Then coming to today's hearing, just to indicate, before we do the introductions, we received some time ago a letter from Mr. Gonsi from the Eastern Cape with regard to challenges he's experiencing with regard to the Provident Fund. We felt, looked at his presentation and said, well, let him come to Parliament and explain. It's a people's parliament. If there's concerns from citizens, we as the Portfolio Committee must hear it. We must deliberate on it and see how we can deal with the situation. So we've also invited the trustees of the Private Security Sector Provident Fund. We've got also, I think, the Security Alliance with us, Private Security Alliance, and also CIRA, the board. The chair is here, the deputy chair. I see also the CEO. Welcome. I will give it an opportunity for them to introduce themselves. Let's go first to the members.
Goedemorgen, dames en heren. Mijn naam is Engie Mulewati. Ik is al net van de committee en dank u.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Engie Domola, a member of the Portfolio Committee. I thank you.
Good morning, my name is Philip Musawa, I'm a member of the committee. Thanks.
Presenter, over to you, Mr. Bonsi. Okay, sorry.
Good morning, I'm Jerome Marke, a member of the committee.
Thank you, honorable members.
I'm Mons Malada, the secretary of TAPSOSA.
Right, let's then go to the rest of the delegation of the program.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Kenny Honten. Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Mr. Daniel from TAPSOSA.
Mr. Pashao from TAPSOSA.
Good morning, Steve Ferrari, CEO of the Security Industry Alliance.
Good morning, Robert Dewey from Private Security Sector Product and Trustee.
Good morning, Kobus Boerenstein, I'm the chairman of the Private Security Sector Problem Fund. Thank you.
Good morning, Anesh Sunder, legal consultant to the Private Security Sector Problem Fund.
Good morning, my name is Arvin Komuzarapay, Secretary for Police Service.
Mr. Mabele, honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson. Apologies for my late arrival. Good morning, Gamusa Kelembele, member of the committee.
Thank you very much. We're going to start immediately due to the time constraints and 10 minutes. You're welcome, sir.
Chatterton.
Chatterton.
We basically here as CAPSOSA to make our submission to this committee on behalf of our members and other interested companies, security companies. The organization, this organization called CAPSOSA, was formed last year, 2015, as a result of complaints that we were getting from our members due to issues of monopoly capital that are happening in the industry. I'll strictly go into our presentation, but I'm hoping that members have already get our submission, so I'll just be briefly on our presentation.
Yeah, maybe just leave that all the presentations were made available, I think, and members, so you can go to the highlights, thank you.
Okay. We need to highlight something that I think when the fund is going to respond, they might use this to capitalize on our submission, that we are a new organization which is still busy trying to finalize our registration with the Department of Labor. But we are operational because we have got members that have got interest in the industry. The submission is concerning around issues of misuse of the Provident Fund by certain section of security employers. The fund is well known by the name of SSFPF. The submission is sought to request that Parliament intervene on what seems to be continuous abuse of power by the white employers and institutions of national importance such as FSP. We begin with the following submission to highlight our outcry and frustrations. We'll only deal with the highlights in our presentation so that members of Parliament could read through the details contained in the submission in their own time. The appointment of trustees remains problematic as it excludes the significant section of employers and employees who are direct participants in the fund. In illustrating the challenges, we highlight the following matters. In terms of the Act, the Pension Fund Act, Section 7A, members should elect member trustee without attempting to draw any legal argument. The reading of this section is presupposed that the other 50% shall be elected by employers who are participating employees and 50% by members employees. We are not informed of the reasons that led to FSB granting the exemption for the participating employers and members not to have the direct right to elect employers and members trustees. It would appear that FSB, in the material reasonable grounds, decided to use representation of a small grouping of white employers that portrays themselves as organized employers and trade and trade unions that are captured through closed shop agreements with these employers. Our members are accordingly not prepared to be represented by the current employer trustee who have deliberately excluded black employers. We note the FSB granting of exemption to allow this grouping to undermine the democratic rights of participating employer to vote for the trustees of their choice, but rather to allow Sansia and Sasa to appoint trustees on behalf of all participating employers. It is our belief that FSB should have tested this view with all participating employers and members before arriving at the exemption conclusion. We fail to see how FSB can continue to unilaterally decide to grant exemption for the exclusion of majority. It is common cause that majority of employers' trustees in this current board are not even shareholders or employees or employers, but rather some of them are pensioners. We further contend that if the status quo is allowed to continue, it will continue the agenda of liquidation of predominantly black companies by the predominantly white companies. The result of this narrow view by FSB is that a bigger portion of the employers are relegated to PSSF as a way to demonstrate their disapproval of FSB decision. We feel that our democratic rights to have trustee of our choice is being trampled upon. It is improper that we are living in the 23rd century of our democracy, that institutions of national importance remain used to promote the agenda of the few against that of majority. We can no longer be regarded as inferior and continue to be discriminated against through utilization of unfair processes. Chairperson, for us, this is a fundamental as it touches to our core rights of existence and the rights to trade without discriminated and intimidated, and harassment that is due to our color of skin. There can be no us without us, and we can't keep quiet whilst we continue to be oppressed. The recent court actions by members of SANZIA and SASA against tender boards for awarding tenders in favor of black companies is a proof of course of action that PSSFP is used as a mechanism to liquidate black-owned companies. The mere fact that PSSF, without the mandate of the board, is used to support court actions by members of SANZIA and SASA. Thank you. Yeah, one is not used to present on these platforms, so you get a bit scared. So thank you. Board and predominantly black-owned companies demonstrate the extent of abuse of power by some trustees and the principal officer of the fund. It is our contention that PSSF, PF, should never be used as an intervention tool to block certain companies to obtain tenders. The role of the fund should is reduced to meddling with the awarding of tenders and not the policing of the non-compliance. Resources intended for the benefits members are allowed to misuse, advance the status quo as a white supremacy and black people expected that they should enjoy the right to trade without unfair control of the white master. This submission is further motivated by the recent submission made to the Registrar of Labour by the trade union SANZIA and SASA and the alleged deregistered other employers' organizations applying for the registration of the National Bargaining Council, which notice is attached here as Annexure A. The notice demonstrates the lack of representation by organization, but afforded the right by FSB to appoint trustee to detriment of majority. The representation in the sector is addressed in detail under the sections of the National Bargaining Council below. The Department of Labor committed an error in the conclusion that the fund established in terms of the Pension Fund Act is capable to be granted compulsory status while this fund is not under the Department of Labor. The Basic Conditions of Employment Act No. 66 of 1995, Section 43, powers and functions of the Statutory Council. The powers and functions of the Statutory Council are to establish and administer pension, provident, medical aid, sick pay, holiday, unemployment schemes, or funds of any similar scheme of funds with the benefit of one or more of the parties to the Statutory Council or their members, and to conclude collective agreements to give effect to matters of and mentioned in the paragraph A, D, and C. We are disabled to establish as to where the Minister of Labour is empowered to promulgate one fund without the provision of Section 43. We believe that by promulgating one of fund, she errs the constitutional provision. We are of the view that the role of the Minister should be established provident fund rates, the eligibility of members and criteria for funds to coexist. The establishment and management of this fund should be left under its jurisdiction of FSB in line with the provision of the Provident Fund Act. There is also allegation of abuse of power and functions by member trustee who are accused by other unions and members of using member benefits certificates only to members who are willing to join their unions on a basis that they have access to the member benefit statement. According to the allegation, benefit statements are printed once a member has signed upon the stock order form for the union. It is further alleged that these unions are also arranged with some employers to grant them workplace closed shop agreements. In return, they will be protected when they are non-compliant. I think Mr. Robert can also attest to this, because this union has got close relations with some of these employers. We request the Honourable Members of Parliament to investigate such allegations by doing random inspection to all companies where closed shop agreements have been signed with unions currently represented in the board. A list of such unions could be obtained from the CCMA. The
final rule of the PSS provides provisions on disqualification of trustees.
It's 10 minutes, I'll give you an additional 7 minutes, but then you must summarize.
Okay.
I'll just say all the presenters, 17 minutes, but please speak to that time, I think.
Yeah. The final rules of PSS provides provision of disqualification of trustees. We are aware that one of the trustees currently in the office was declared by a previous board that he was in breach of the fund code of conduct and therefore prohibited from holding office. We are told that the reason was because of the various transgressions of the code of conduct by unilaterally acting on for a leak of his own, and as can be seen by the commission that appointed by the board to investigate the matter. It was reported that the board could not condone such conduct, and this is a freedom determining factor not to accept the nomination. The board's decision was not to accept his nomination, but the High Court directed the matter should be referred to FSB by the trustee, although did not avail with the new board. And the person concerned is the chairperson of the fund, Mr. Chairperson. The commissioner finds, I'll go on and deal with that because that is the allegation that is put there, which we have got evidence. There was an article in the newspaper that linked him with one particular service provider where money were paid in advance in terms of them going to be able to deal with death certificate. There were recent further media reports that linked the trustee silent partner to the same service provider. Notwithstanding the fact that the trustee should protect and promote the objectives of the fund, we continue to experience continued agenda orchestrated against black-owned companies, targeting predominantly black-owned companies being advocated by Sansia and Sasa using their deployments. Maybe let me rush because of time and deal with our highlights to Parliament Committee to note. It was alleged that members of Sansia and Sasa lost tender to there was an incident in KZN when they lost a tender and they went in and obtained the information of that particular competitor from the fund. And our question is to say the information should be privileged. And these are people that are using their own organization to go and obtain information. The second matter was an alleged push of previous board chairperson to sign a confirmatory affidavit without the mandate of the board. The then chairperson so brilliantly refused to sign this affidavit, and it was the key for the members of SASA to succeed in their litigation, hence they lost. The loss attached emails, there's emails to prove to that factor, and I think the former chairperson and the current chairperson are here. They can attest to their argument around the issue. Based on the upset grounds set above, particularly having regards to the abuse of power and function behind misuse of the resources of the fund, we request the disbandment of the PSSF board and the FSB appointment an interim board to implement to act in relation to the rights to vote for the members and participating employees. We want to point out that all our attempts to cooperate and hold meetings with the representative of the trustees were never enjoyed fruitful engagement. Instead, we were always being mistreated. These trustees are not able to execute their fiduciary duties and preoccupied by agenda of exclusion. The principal officer is not able to separate between his roles and the need of the individual trustee that seeks to protect big white companies. He must also be replaced with capable and fit proper. Maybe that is the reason why they left him because he's not here and he's the accounting officer was supposed to be here representing the fund. But because he doesn't agree with them or for some reason or maybe because of his incompetence, he's not here. The Minister of Labour is requested to allow democratic instrument in this sector by allowing the competition in relation to the number of competing funds. We believe that there must be more than one provident fund because the existing fund chairperson is failing. It doesn't even hold AGMs. The Parliament is requested to conduct an investigation on running of the board affairs and the fund, including looting of resources and to investigate the manipulation of the funds and to target certain companies and the fund being used refused to interfere in the awarding tenders. We are told members of the fund earn something like 150,000 rand a month, and supposedly they are not supposed to be full-time employees because already the administrator has been appointed. The Parliament is requested.
2 minutes.
Okay. The Parliament is requested to call in SACITA in order and in distributing its resources because they are just a few. The PCR to finalize its research on the industry transformation framework and circulate its findings to the engagement of for engagement with stakeholders. Even as the Minister of Police and other any minister who is invited to attend the so-called bravery awards not to attend, as it does not represent the bravery of men and women within the industry, but rather it instead used to misuse the very same fund by sponsoring the use that awards only to companies members of this organization. And we further request PCR to pull out as a partner and establish the events that will award men and women across the country. Chairperson, last year we have a very laughing matter, and I'm sorry if SPCA are here, I'll be reprimanded. When a dog was awarded the bravery award instead of poor people that worked across the country as security guards, and some of them are crippled, but a dog comes in and gets a bravery award. In my village, when I look at a dog, I use a certain way of telling it to go away from me. But then I can't do that to a human being. But when you give a dog an award and you don't award a human being, it's an insult to human. I think that's the end of our presentation, Chairperson. Realebuha, Rolibuwa, Yakensa, Inkosi, Siyabulela. If time was on our side, would indicate more of the issues that we really are of great concern of how the fund is being abused. But because of time, I think we've made our own inputs, and members of parliament will have to read the submission in order to be more informed of how this beautiful fund of the most poorest of our poor people is being misused, and they don't get their own benefits as intended. But instead, the trustee are enjoying the benefits of this fund. They are even using it to actually counteract what we call the gains of the BEE in the industry. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for your presentation. The next presenter, I think, is Sira. 17 minutes. Thank you, sir. Provides for a range of benefits, including
retirement, disability, death and funeral benefits for its members, which are basically the security officers in the private security industry. The requirements and obligations provided within the sectoral determination 6, published by the Minister of Labour, and then obviously the fund rules in itself. Now, the fund itself is governed by a board of trustees, as already been informed. The trustees have obviously direct control and oversee the operations of the fund in terms of the fund rules and the Pension Funds Act, and into an agreement by with an administrator to manage the affairs of the fund. Now, currently, in terms of the fund rules, the trustees consist of 12 member trustees, and I might mention just one vote each, and then 6 employer trustees with 2 votes each, obviously to make it equal to the number of member trustees, and then 1 independent trustee. The terms of office is 5 years, and the principal officer is appointed by the trustees. CIRA is not involved in the establishment of the fund or serve as a, on the board of trustees. We are the regulator of the private security industry in terms of our own mandate in terms of the CIRA Act. Now, generally, in terms of our role with, in terms of the respect of the Provident Fund, as I mentioned, we are mandated in terms of the CIRA Act to regulate the security industry in the public and national interest, and obviously the interests of the security industry itself. The objects of our Act obviously highlight also, you know, our obligation to promote and protect and the enforcement of the rights of security officers and other employees in the private security industry. And there comes our role in terms of ensuring, also in terms of labour legislation, that employers meet their obligation towards the employees as far as sectoral determination 6 is concerned. And we do so, obviously, in terms of our objects, through active monitoring and investigation, and particularly through the work of our inspectorate department. The Minister of Police also promulgated the Code of Conduct for Security Service Providers in 2003, which set certain rules and minimum standards that the private security industry must meet. Just to highlight some of those rules, and it's a specific chapter that deals with the obligation employers got towards their employees in terms of the Code of Conduct rules. And that includes that the employer may not abuse or exploit an employee and must ensure that the employee receives the full wages and all other service benefits due to him or her as described in terms of applicable legislation. In this particular case, it's obviously referring to the sectoral determination 6, which provides for the minimum conditions of employment in the private and for the private security sector, including minimum wages, working conditions, and, as I mentioned, the provisions of the private security sector Provident Fund, which is a statutory fund in terms of the sectoral determination. And then obviously employers must comply with all the implications in terms of law. And from a CIRA perspective, we will then verify from our own inspections whether the security business meets these obligations in terms of labour legislation, including registration and compliance with the Provident Fund. Our general interaction between CIRA and the Provident Fund, we cooperate in order to influence compliance with the fund because it is a statutory fund and we've got this obligation to ensure that it's compliance in terms of labour legislation. We do have a signed memorandum of understanding between ourselves and the fund to share information in order to drive the compliance agenda. One of the big issues that that the fund is experiencing is the reporting of members and registration of businesses on the fund, and we obviously liaise with one another to see whether it is correct numbers being presented to the fund in terms of the workforce versus our records that we keep in terms of our legislation, where employers are also obliged to report the number of security officers to ourselves. So we do liaise with one another to draw a bit of comparison and to see whether it is actually compliant. CIRA participate also with the Provident Fund on an annual basis with their member and employer information sessions. We do about 60 sessions nationally in all the provinces. And we also include as part of our registration requirements that, you know, the businesses must demonstrate that they are tax compliant as well as registered with the Provident Fund in the case where they're going to render security services in the guarding sector. Again, because it's a statutory fund, we are obliged to ensure that the members are, in the end of the day, protected. We also do it in terms of our renewal of registration project, where we require businesses to demonstrate that they are registered with the Provident Fund. Now, in terms of compliance with the Provident Fund, I think, first of number of stakeholders. First of all, because the Provident Fund is established as a statutory fund, in terms of labor legislation, the Department of Labor has got a significant role to play. Because not any non-compliance to register with the Provost PHSPF or pay contributions in terms of the requirements highlighted in the sectoral determination must be dealt with the Department of Labor because it's offense in terms of their legislation. We do have a lot of interaction with the pension fund adjudicator where complainants will go to the pension fund adjudicator in terms of non-compliance with the pension fund act. But FSB is obviously an important stakeholder, and we also have the South African Police Service. We do have incidents where employers deduct monies from employees' wages but do not pay it over to the fund, and then obviously the complainant can lay a charge of theft against the employees. So SAFs also play a role in that environment. And then your employer organisation and trade unions, obviously in terms of their pressure, in terms of labour, the Labour Relations Act. Civil litigation, we're aware of that the fund also institute civil litigation in cases where membership fees are due. And then CIRA, as I highlighted, we do have a role to play in this environment. Our code of conduct is applicable on all employers, and obviously employers need to meet the obligations in terms of labour legislation. Chairperson, this is just an indication of since the inception of the fund in 2002, the number of prosecutions that we have done in terms of the Code of Conduct for Security Service Providers, total of 6,377 until the end of July 2017. We experience a high level of non-compliance with the requirements with this fund, not generally on registration, but once a business is registered, they need to continue to comply with the obligations, including submitting member schedules, continuing to pay over the membership fee. So we do find, unfortunately, cases where employers are registered, but at some point in time they will stop paying the member contributions to the fund. And then, obviously, from CIRA's side, we will then step in and take the necessary action and code of conduct in order to change the behaviour of those non-compliant security service providers. This is just a bit of an analysis in terms of compliance levels from 2011 to 2017. This is the, you know, in the last 6 years, in terms of compliance levels of businesses that we've been inspecting, you'll see, you know, the latest figures about 81% of businesses in the security guarding sector are compliant with the fund, but we do see a bit of a downward trend there, and that is usually to do with price pressures, but it's obviously different reasons or different motivations for non-compliance, and unfortunately profit maximization is usually the one that's highest on the top when it comes to that particular motivation that drives non-compliance. This is just for information sake also for the same period, just a quarterly breakdown in terms of the national figure from inspections that we do versus the levels of non-compliance that we've identified. It's about 17% in the last quarter of businesses that are non-compliant with the private security sector statutory program fund. General complaints, and it's been highlighted by TopSourcer as well, that we received, obviously, because we're involved in enforcing a requirement in terms of labour legislation, the industry do approach us and highlight areas of non-of challenges they experience in the Provident Fund. One part of it's the allegation of poor administration of the fund, updating membership schedules on a regular basis, unallocated contribution accounts. There's also complaints of the delay in member benefit statements sometimes that's being issued, delay in backlog in claims, where members claim their benefits when they resign, they have title to claim it, or when there's a death. There's sometimes delay in those allegations that's being raised. We've heard about the allegations of mismanagement of funds. One of the problematic areas that's always highlighted by a big part of the industry is as well the exemption criteria for the Provident Fund and variation. As I mentioned, the Provident PHSPF is a statutory fund in terms of labour legislation, so all employers need to belong to this particular fund. And there is exemption criteria in terms of the labour legislation when a business can apply for an exemption, but it's very limited because it actually only provides for your entitlement to apply for an exemption if you belong to a registered Provident Fund prior to 2002, and then the trustees or there's a committee that will look into that exemption and highlighted. I believe the Tapsosa issue talked about the issue of letters of good standing, and they believe that the letters of good standing sometimes, or the use of letters of good standing by a provident fund, is at the exclusion of other businesses. And generally, our role from CIRA's side is we try to stimulate discussions between the agreed parties, members of the industry, and the fund to work towards solutions. Generally, we obviously from our side we will continue to ensure that there's compliance with the legislation, that the problem fund is there, established in terms of act of made by the Minister of Labour, and we will continue obviously from our side to drive the compliance agenda. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Within the time limit, thank you. The next presenters, trustees. Thank you. 17 minutes.
Members. I think I'm going to skip some of my slides because I think I don't want to repeat some of the things that CIRA has already mentioned. So obviously we know how the fund was established. There is some exemptions in terms of members for the fund, such as managers as defined in the sectoral determination, as well as those employed in the cash and transit sector, as they form part of the bargaining council for the road freight and logistics industry. In terms of exemptions of companies to the fund, The only exception to participation in the PSSPF is if the employer security service provider, as well as all his employees, had already established a provident fund prior to 30 March 2001, or could produce documentary proof that they had already commenced negotiations to establish their own provident fund by that date. These employees would have to apply for exemption from participation in the PSSPF annually as part of the exemption criteria, which have to satisfy the PSSPF, that their funds benefits were equal or better than that of the PSSPF, or that their funds finances were equal to or better than that of the PSSPF. So this is an annual exemption that these companies that already have exemption has to reapply for exemption so that we can make sure that we make sure that those companies are still living up to the exemption criteria. I just want to mention maybe that this stage that the fund is considering to establish an independent body that will look at exemption applications. That is something that is in the making currently. Those are benefits. Just a quick summary what the PSSPF provides for members is we have 39 times monthly salary as a death benefit, 39 times monthly salary as a permanent and total disability benefit. We have a 30,000 funeral benefit for the member and the spouse, just to also include three spouses into this benefit. And then there's some reduced benefits on the sliding scale for minor children and stillbirth. Also includes the put up of a tombstone, counselling amongst other support structures. We also have cover for the loss of body parts, and that benefit is calculated also on the sliding scale according to the level of such a loss. Just quickly in terms of the fund's investment value, our portfolio is currently sitting just close to 6 billion, in actual fact just a little bit over 6 billion right now, and realising an annual growth of close to 14% net after costs. And I think very few funds can consistently match that growth. We do this more specifically by having a dedicated investment subcommittee that meets on a monthly basis. We have an investment consultant that we deal with that assists us in terms of looking at the markets. As we know, the economies are going up and down, so it's quite difficult in these days, but we monitor it on a monthly basis. Just in terms of some developments, and I won't cover anything, just safe to say that a new board took office with effect from 1 September last year. The details as well as the committees that they serve under is available on our website. We also appointed a new administrator effective 1 September 2016 in the form of SALT employee benefits. The That was after struggling for almost 6 years with APSA consultants, actuaries, where we've had numerous administrative problems and issues around the payment of claims, etc., etc. And although the Board of Trustees tried their best to remedy those issues with the previous administrator, eventually we just had to say, let's appoint a new administrator. I'm very happy to say that since the inception of SALT in 1 September 2016, that in fact we've paid out 68,351 claims, which is a huge amount of claims, and we have just about to the point where we can say we have eradicated the backlog of claims that need to be paid. I'm not going to talk about the systems that SALT is developing, so I have to say just in short that there's an interactive web service that's going to be provided to employers that will make it much easier for them to put their payments as well as their schedules into that system. They would be able to generate their own benefit statements, they would be able to generate their own compliance letters. Compliance letters is already being able to be generated automatically via the fund's own portal system if the employers choose to register to that opportunity. Also, it's the same to say that we are extending, we've got offices in the 5 major cities in South Africa, but to get to more members over the country, we have currently got 2 free mobile offices. If I say offices, I really mean offices. They are fitted out with computers, printers, everything else, so they serve members throughout the country, and the fund is in the process of purchasing another 3 of those vehicles to reach. The, as we know, security offices are spread, really spread wide across the country on a national basis. In terms of governance, the fund believes in a good governance structure. We assist the Board of Trustees to deliver a long-term stakeholder value in that regard. We have employed a full-time risk officer was employed to provide reasonable assurance regarding the achievement of objectives in terms of our effectiveness and efficiency of operations, the reliability of financial reporting and compliance with laws and regulations. We are also now in the process of, we've purchased an audit or compliance and audit software solution called Barnell. The implementation of that is currently happening as well as the training of trustees and service providers to use that system. It's a very effective system in terms of handling compliance. And what you are doing on a daily basis in terms of your risk management. We believe that we will be the first fund in South Africa to utilize such a software system, and it will be very transparent and everybody will be able to participate in that and see where the levels of compliance is in the fund. The fund's employees are also at the heart of its operations, and they actively interface with our members, talking more specifically about our front office staff and our client liaison officers. So we also look after our members as far as we possibly can. Unallocated contributions, this is one of the biggest reasons why we felt, apart from the payment of claims, that we had to move from one administrator to the other. We inherited an unallocated contribution amount from the previous administrator in the form of ACA, APSA Consultants and Actuaries, to the tune of 457 million rand. And as in terms of unallocated from SALT, 91.4 million as at the end of April. What we have done, a special task team has been set up to reduce this unallocated contribution amount significantly during the current year, and currently the unallocated contribution stands at 283 million. So we've made serious inroads in terms of allocating those monies. The unallocation of monies is due to various reasons for the unallocations of being signed. I think I just need to spend a minute or two on that, is that we receive contributions from employers, but sometimes we do not receive the schedules, so we don't know who to allocate that money to, or the schedule and the payment does not correspond with each other, or even if the schedules are there, the information on the schedules is not complete, there's not ID numbers on it, or incorrect ID numbers on those schedules. According to the Act, if the fund receives a payment and a schedule that does not match each other, we cannot allocate that money. So we then have to go back to that employer, establish what is the issue, try and get the correct schedules from that employer, and then we can allocate those monies. But as you can see, we're making inroads on that. The goal, one of the goals of the fund from the strategic session that was held in December last year, is that we will try and eradicate 2 things, the unallocated contributions by the end of 2017, as well as the backlog of claims by the end of 2017. Obviously, in terms of our concerns, and I think that's a concern that was also echoed by my colleague from CIRA, is the exorbitant level of non-compliance in the security industry, especially in the employer's failure or refusal or omission to participate therein, thereby depriving the employees from the above-mentioned benefits, as I've mentioned. And just for example, currently, I'll just make it short, security businesses that do guarding in South Africa, currently there's 6,847 of them registered with the fund, with CIRA. Security businesses participating in the PSSBF is 3,451, and out of that 3,451 that participate and are registered with the fund, only 523 of them are 100% compliant. So people don't always understand, and we get a lot of arguments in terms of our compliance letters and things like that, but even if you go according to the Pension Funds Act, which for example will tell you that your contributions need to reach your fund that you are paying to by the 7th of the month, if you only pay on the 9th or the 10th of the month, you are not compliant. So that makes it difficult. So that's why I'm saying that the level of compliance is still very high. In terms of offices registered with CIRA, that is active, 497,000, and we currently have 242,000 of them participating actively in the fund. So as you can see, there's still a huge amount of security employees out there that are not covered by this fund and the benefits. Just for in terms of compliance and some of the legal action that we're busy with, I would just like to hand over to the fund's official legal consultant, Mr. Adesh Sundar.
Thank you very much.
6 minutes, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the issue around compliance is driven in terms of Section 13A of the Pension Funds Act. The fund is a creature of statute. The trustees as the custodians of the fund need to ensure that they act in line with that. Section 13A is very definitive. It requires civil, it requires criminal action against employers who are non-compliant. The issue around Section 13A is not a white or black employer issue. It is an issue to deal with non-compliance as and when it arises. The fund commenced the project about 5 years ago in order to deal with the issue of non-compliance, and has made very satisfactory progress in this regard over that period. There are multiple roles that the fund has got to play in this process. This relates to criminal as well as civil action. The challenges have come through the criminal aspect of it, as the civil aspect seems to roll on quite nicely. The criminal aspect is the stumbling block arises in terms of the reporting to the SAPS and the difficulty that the SAPS has in taking the matters forward. Of the 3,451 participating employers that have that play on the fund or participate on the fund, 2,928 of these employers are non-compliant. This gives you some sense of the level of non-compliance that the trustees have got to deal with very, very quickly to arrest the problem. In April 2017, there were 469 payment arrangements or AODs that were signed, acknowledgements of debt. That was up from the 2016 period at the same time of 394. The amount that the trustees of the private security sector provident fund have managed to collect from non-compliant employers and put back into the pockets or the accounts of members amounted to 361 million rand, which was up from 275 million rand the prior year. So there has been significant progress that has been made there. The fund has also entered into litigation against non-compliant employers. There's 256 matters that are currently on the go. There are 186 matters as far as the criminal aspect is concerned that is currently on the go as well. CIRA has indicated that the adjudicator has complained in terms of the number of complaints that comes through her offices. This exceeds 300 matters a month, which is significant, which means that the issue of non-compliance is a serious issue that is being felt by the members at the lower level. The non-compliance by the employer effectively creates a problem in that the 7.5% that's either where the employer does not participate in the fund,
the 7.5% is saved by the employer and put back into the business. Alternatively, you have a situation where the employer deducts the contribution from the member and holds back the 7.5% that is designated for the member as well as his contribution, effectively putting him at 15% advantage as far as business is concerned. Unfortunately, the situation you've got is that members are unaware of this. All they see is the deduction from their salary, but they do not see confirmation that the money actually hits the retirement fund. And they are blissfully unaware, which is a serious challenge. As far as the amendment to the Pension Funds Act is concerned, it recriminalized the non-compliance with Section 13A of the Pension Funds Act, and in the instance an employer is found guilty, the directors of such a company can jointly and severally be held liable in their personal capacity, and then also prosecuted criminally, and they could face a fine of up to 10 million rand or 10 years in prison. The trustees in pursuing non-compliant employers are merely giving effect to the above. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Within the time limit, is there any other presentation? Security Alliance?
Yes, Chair.
I just want to, is it possible that we can have hard copies of that presentation? Because it's difficult, it's going to be difficult for the members to interact if we don't have got copies. Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentations that was made. We appreciate that. It's quite clear from the presentations that some of the issues, and I think four of the issues mentioned by the first speaker, falls actually with the Department of Labour, and it's really the role of the Portfolio Committee on Labour. But of course, that's another process, and maybe some of those issues must be channeled there. So after today's meeting, I think that will be the proper vehicle for that. But of course, from the security industry regulator and from the Portfolio Committee's mandate, of course, we will focus on those issues. That's really within our mandate. So we will then go to questions immediately from the members to the different role players and presentations. Maybe a couple from my side, and then I'll go to Honourable Molabatsi. In terms of the role of CEDA, I just want to get an indication. CEDA is apparently not represented on the board. There's been mention made of a memorandum of understanding. Some of the issues raised by the complainant, isn't some of those matters issues that can be included in the memorandum of understanding of CEDA with the pension board? I just want to get a view on that, you know, going forward to solve maybe some of the issues. I just want to get an indication on that. And then in terms of the representation on the board, why is CEDA not on the board? I just want to get a sense. Then my question to the board itself, the trustees, there has been a complaint of transformation on the board. Can we get a response on that? And then there was an indication that the previous service provider wasn't efficient, but in terms of your own presentation, there's still 91 million rand unallocated. So that means there might be members of security companies that may be injured, they might die, and there will be no recourse, or they won't be able to be identified. Now, what is being done by the trustees to ensure that that project is dealt with as a matter of urgency? Right, let's go to the members. Honourable Molabatsi.
Thank you, Chairperson. The MOU signed by CEDA and PFS, PF, of sharing information, is it adhered to? My second one, can you, the board, tell us about the death and disability reserve account? My next one is about the, do you agree with the sentiment that some of your shareholders are pensioners? My next one, how many checks as Mbuno Nala Om Sot. And to go with that, have you obtained a legal opinion in regard to the recent newspaper report that the owner of Mbuno Nala has been deported back to Zimbabwe and the report regarding the disappearance of funds in one of the mining funds that they ran? Thanks, Chair, for now.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for your presentation. In slide 7, you are talking about the memorandum of understanding. When was the memorandum of understanding between Sera and Sera expired? Now, the second question, the new board came into effect on the same day as the new administration. Was this a decision of the previous board? My third question, how many security officers are killed or disabled on or off duty? My fourth question, how effective has the appointment of a risk officer been? My fifth question, which is the last, how often are the financial statements of the fund audited? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Flongu, you're welcome.
No, Chairperson, I think my question will go to Sera. With regard to when rating the levels of non-compliance of companies that are non-compliant with the fund, I wonder even only what is the role of Sera in ensuring that there is total compliance, because if you compare the total number of non-compliant and even those that have been prosecuted, you find that prosecution it seems to be rather very low almost in all areas, which means that there is something really wrong going on there in these companies. Now, maybe the person, is it because maybe of weaknesses within Sera, or maybe Sera would actually then expect Parliament to actually empower it in terms of passing more legislation in order to have in this, because to me it's very, very shocking that you will find that workers, when they go to pension, some of them tend to lose their benefits. I think that's a very, very, very matter of serious concern. So where is the problem? Is Sera lacking capacity to deal with this? Do you have strong, effective palliative measures, except maybe taking the matters to court? As to that, do you have palliative measures that you can actually then put in place in order to ensure that those people, if they fail to or refuse to comply, they even lose business? Because if then there is no such, I think these records as they are presented here, they paint to me a very, very, very big picture, which means that the workers really have got a serious problem. Then lastly, Chairperson, I have marked due to time, in terms of this bargaining council, it was formed out of the legislation of 1950 something. Don't you see maybe the need even of repealing this particular thing? Who says to repeal this? Is it Sera or maybe the fund itself? Because it seems there is something totally wrong there in that particular area, which might actually then promote the previous establishment to have an upper hand. So if maybe
much. Honourable Bailey and then Honourable Bong.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's just one question from my side, and it's to seek clarity on an aspect that's been touched on but I don't quite have adequate grip of. And it's this matter of employer and member representation on the Provident Fund and exactly how that happens. I might have missed the relevant details in my review of the written submissions as well as the oral presentations now, but I'm not yet quite clear in my head, so if I can ask the respective parties, both Tapsosa from their perspective and the Provident Fund board, is what is the exact process of determining the allocation of the trustees, both member trustees and employer trustees, because the one grievance from the first presentation is that there's been what I've written as an exclusion from the process of the appointments of those representatives. So if I can understand what is the required process and therefore how that required process either was not complied with, which lead to the grievance, or whether the process is flawed in its design, therefore giving birth to the grievance. And I'm also then very interested to know how the other dimension is then about the member trustees, because if so many members of the fund, of the Provident Fund, are going to be victim to, you know, previous maladministration because there's unallocated benefits and that sort of thing, how were the members given a chance in the first place to contribute to the selection of the trustees on the board who would look after their interests? So I'm just asking for a descriptive picture of what is meant to happen so that we can understand where things went wrong or if the problem with the design of that process. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable Marke.
Thank you, Chairperson. One or two questions. I'm just concerned that the role of CIRA is to ensure that employee security officers are not exploited, and they need to protect and enforce the rights of security guards in the industry. But they don't seem to have the powers to do that in some cases. They will always refer to the Department of Labor. And to Tapsosa, the question would be, or to both CIRA and Tapsosa, is there any necessity to change legislation? Because that is our job, in order to streamline all of this, especially if it comes to, there will always be a resistance to transformation. If the Pension Fund Act is of 1956, I don't think there was any black at that time who owned security companies. I'm not well vested in that, but it will mean that something needs to be changed to cover the new environment. And then it will be within Tapsosa and maybe CIRA to identify those areas that need to be changed in order that there must be transformation. And it's the duty of the legislators who are legislators who are sitting here to make sure that that happens. Otherwise, it will simply be lip service.
let's go to the presenters first. Let's go in the order of presentation. First, Aphosa, questions that they want to deal with, then Sira, and then the trustees. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will deal with the two questions that has to do with firstly what Honorable Mbele was asking about the structure of the fund. From our side, why we are here today is that we try to engage. We are the majority of the black owners are more than what the white owners are in the industry. We are the majority. And while we are the majority, we are not even serving on the trustee board. We are not there. They have made their own white voice club. And we try to engage with them and they refuse to talk to us. Hence, we decided to bring this matter to Parliament. At some meeting, there was a bit of peace fighting where it emanated to go to that way. Colleagues can attest to that. Because they believe this thing was started by their fathers some time ago. That's their belief, that it belongs to their fathers, it belongs to them. We cannot do nothing about it. Number two, to the last honorable member that was speaking, yes, indeed, there is a need for a legislation to be changed. Because the reason why we're finding ourselves where we are today is because CIRA has nothing to do with the Provident Fund in terms of its mandate. And then that particular mandate falls within the Department of Labor. But the Provident Fund wants to become autonomous in terms of CIRA, how they are dealing with us as employers in the industry. So they are not there as a board member to look at the interest of us as employers. I mean, I'm an employer. If you change from one service provider to the other, you don't talk to me. You decide to do it at your own interest. You come and tell me I must comply with this person from the state. It can't be like that. I contribute 7.5% of my money and to my employees today. As I'm talking to you here today, my employees don't have statements of benefit. But these gentlemen, they say they are saving in their board. They are there to serve their own interest of their companies, and they capture the union that must fall within them. And we as the black employers are painted with the black with the paint to say that we are non-compliant. And the reason why they are doing it is for them to have a leverage over us in terms of tender. They go to the extent, the issue of non-compliance that you see there, they go to the extent when a bigger tender comes out, they refuse to issue letter of compliance to us. And you start to asking yourself a question. Why is CIRA issuing a letter of compliance for me to be in a service provider? But the Provident Fund also want to issue a letter of compliance. They are not there to issue a letter of compliance. They are there to run the affairs of the fund. But they are using their letter of compliance as a license for me to trade. But CIRA has said, Mr. Ponzi, you can trade. Here you go. And give me the letter of good standing. But they also want to control on top of what CIRA is doing. They want to have their own authority over us. So that is oppression at the moment. Thank
you. I'll deal with, even if it's not specifically pointed to us, but I think there's a need for us to highlight, because certain people might put lies. The issue of Vunon Alliance Salt, the gentleman who was representing them as a legal advisor had actually conducted a due diligence on the relationship between Vunon Alliance Salt. And it was found without reasonable doubt that there is a relationship. Furthermore, it's not only what happens there with the fund is that you will find a fund administrator that has got service providers under him, but all these companies circulate around the very similar people. And it's not that these fund trustees are not aware. It's that they are aware there could have been that there is some certain arrangements with them that actually prevails. So Vunon Alliance Salt are actually, I think they can provide a document that they have done to actually prove to that. The issue of the exemption that was dealt with, the difficulties is that they are the player and the referee at the same time. If you need exemption, you actually need to go to them, and they don't do that. They don't give out exemptions because this fund is squeezed to us to a point where, and this is what has happened, maybe let me paint a picture. You get a situation where you become so indebted to the fund And by you being indebted to the fund, they then came from behind and said to you, we can give you an offer and buy your company out, and then we will settle your debts, and then you become part of them. It is happening and within their unions, their employers' associations, that they own a number of black-owned companies that they've swallowed amongst them because those companies were indebted. So those are the kind of situations that we're experiencing.
Just maybe a follow-up on the process of appointing trustees. What vehicle is there for you to give the presentation on the trustees? In terms of the rules?
What was supposed to happen was, in terms of the Act, it was supposed to be a 50-50 split. And we were supposed to elect members as employees. And even unions were supposed to submit from their unions. But that is not happening. We don't know who appointed that board. We can actually put that to you. The same board served in the previous board when the previous board time expired. When the new board was supposed to be elected, it was just imposed as it is. So there's no changes. From way back, it is similar people that have been running with the board.
Two follow-ups. First, Honourable Bailey, and then Honourable Molabasi. First, Honourable Bailey.
Thanks, Chair. It's exactly on the appointment issue, and I'm hoping we get more light shed from the board perspective when they speak. But, this whole issue has to land and anchor in a specific individual or office. The board won't just materialize out of thin air. So am I correct that the Minister of Labour appoints the members of the board, or are they is there an appointment process or an election process? And if it's an election process, that means there must be some sort of AGM. Who gets to go to that AGM? Those are the details I'm wanting to kind of go step by step, so we can identify where there are shortcomings, if any. Thanks.
From the explanation, it seems the board just recycles people. Now, my direct question is, when was your last AGM?
For Marky?
If I'm not wrong, members of the security, private security companies, are more than the police and defense combined. And I think it will be very dangerous if we don't empower the black one, the black security company owners. They must take their share of that. Because if what they say, the white security companies are in the majority, and they are even more than the security personnel of the country, we might be in danger. I'm saying it in passing. So it must just happen. At least if something goes wrong, we'll be having our share with
you.
Maybe as a quick follow-up, when you have been isolated in the establishment of that board, because you're correct, when it comes to the Provident Fund, the Provident Fund Act is very clear, 50-50. And you are also a player as a contributor to the fund, but you are not gone. Where do you lodge a dispute? Do you lodge a dispute with CIRA or with the fund? Because you can't lodge with the fund, because you don't recognize that body. Where do you lodge it? So that we can actually have clarity. because I'm grappling with this thing of 56. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's get those responses. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Going to the question of Honorable Mbele, is that the baseline of our complaint is that there is no transparency on how the board is appointed. Normally, like here in Parliament, when you want members to serve on various committees or board of SADC, you will go out on advert, people will put their credentials as to why they need to serve there. In this case, there is nothing like that. We are imposed, these people are imposed on us. We did not, there was no transparency processes whereby AGM throughout the country were held and people were told these are the nominees from various employers associations and all that. Nothing of that happened. I'm still maintaining my belief. There is a gentleman in that board that believes his father started the security industry, the CIA as it is today, and they will still want to remain in control, and that's their view. And they don't want to relinquish that power to other people to participate in it. That is how the status quo stands. And then in relation again, I'm going to give you a very example. You go to Mbulo Nala and Salt. All of you can go and Google what is Mbulo Nala. Salt is a subsidiary of Mbulo Nala. And then Bupilo, the underwriting company for the funeral policy of security company, is a subsidiary of Salt. That's it. The question, how did they arrive to that procurement process? We were not told as employers, but we are told to use these people. And then they can take us to court as they want to. But the question is that there are allegations of corruption and fraud of about 13 million that was paid as a kickback for this process, for this transaction to go on. So we cannot challenge all these things, but we have been told that we need to go through that. So to answer you, sir, in relation to the issue of where will we go, I'm going to say you go straight to them. We engage them. We talk to them from the committee of TAPSOSA to say, guys, what you are doing is not right. And they say to us, who are you? That's the question they ask. Who are you? But they know that we are competitors with them in the same industry. I'm going to give you an example. The issue of them wanting to buy, like for instance, the owner of Fidelity, he wants to buy every single company that's got problem with the fund so that he can rescue them and buy their company out. They just bought ADT now. They are currently busy in the process of buying 2RM. And on that particular note, we lodge a complaint against the Competition Commission to say that they want to monopolize, because they, the moment they buy all these companies, they will never want to drop the price in the market.
I needed to highlight the structure of the board now. Maybe there's something that we didn't highlight. Most of them that are sitting there, they don't own a security company. And we don't know who they represent because they are just there. It's supposed to be owners of security companies and unions. But unfortunately, even the union that is sitting there has got a closed shop agreement with these people. So he doesn't say yes or no. He doesn't actually represent the employees. So we're actually sitting with a situation where employees out there, they don't know what is actually happening because the union closed them out. The gentleman who was representing them there as a legal person was actually, how he started, he was a trustee. He was a member trustee. And they wanted legal advice. They used him at a cheaper rate. He said he's offering them a cheaper rate for them to work with him. But along the way, FSB realize that there's a conflict of interest. And it called them to order and says, you can't have a conflict of interest. One person being a service provider at the same time being a trustee member. They then said, no, you go out of being a trustee, you now become a legal advisor. Who appointed that person? And this person always does not prosecute their own companies. He prosecutes us. Within the very same board, they've got companies that owe millions. With people that are trustees, why can't they take them to task? Chairperson, we gave them a test at some point when we were discussing with them. We said, we've got problems with collateral of goods lending. They said, no, write letters to us, talk to us, we can arrange these things. And we did that as a test. Quickly, within 15, 10 minutes, we had letters of goods lending with us. The issue of compliance was never raised. So it means that's what they do in their own corner for themselves, whilst we are suffering here.
Thank you. Let's go to Sira. Those questions aimed at you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think, first of all, we want to emphasize again that we not involved in the Provident Fund and its establishment, because that was done through the procedural termination by the Minister of Labour. So CIRA is not a member of the trustees, and we cannot be enforce ourselves as to be a member of the trustee in terms of the Pension Funds Act. That's the manner of appointment of trustees are provided for in that legislation. What we do in terms of our role is to promote compliance with legislation, all legislation that governs the private security industry. In this particular case, we are referring to labour legislation that provided for the establishment of the private security sector provident fund. In terms of the memorandum of understanding, because CIRA has a database of all registered security businesses as well as registered security officers, the purpose of the MOU was, you know, for us to, and I think the Provident Fund also highlighted the number of businesses registered with the fund versus the number of members that members registered with the fund versus the records that CIRA has, was to collaborate between one another to verify, you know, whether businesses are actually reporting information to the private security sector Provident Fund and vice versa, where the numbers and the details of security personnel they report to the fund can be matched with the information that they are obliged to report to CIRA. This memorandum was signed during 2016, last year. I must add, Chairperson, that the implementation or the full implementation of the MOU has not materialized yet. We do not share specific information yet. From CIRA's side, we are also concerned of what happens with the information that we provide to the fund, whether it be shared with parties outside of the eyes of the fund. So there's further discussions between ourselves still on this in terms of how the information will be given, what level of information will be given, and how the information is at the end of the day managed, because we need to be in a position of trust that what the information that we provide on our database is not abused by the Provident Fund, and I'm sure they feel the same on their side.
Just a moment, it's just a follow-up on that.
Yeah.
It's possible to move by
thanks. Are you not obliged to can question the adherence of this MOU?
Chairperson, if I understand the question is correct, yes, we can. I mean, we can question the adherence to this MOU. We are party in the signature to that MOU, but we need to be satisfied from our side as a regulator that information that we share with the fund is not going to be abused. We haven't received the confidence yet that you know, that the information, you know, will be protected in terms of the MOU. So we haven't fully implemented that part of the MOU in terms of the sharing information. But we do collaborate with one another in terms of, you know, whether a business is legally registered with the Provident Fund, whether they're legally registered with us, and we do a comparison on the actual, just the numbers, you know, in terms of membership numbers reported by the businesses to the fund versus the membership numbers that we have on our side, but not the actual individual information in terms of the security officers. That, as you know, we haven't implemented that yet. There was a question asked, Chairperson, just on the numbers of persons that were injured on duty. Let me just get that. Chairperson, again, this information is information that we actually receive from the Provident Fund, because any claims in terms of death and disability, that will be reported to the Provident Fund, obviously, because there's claims instituted by them. In terms of the last financial year, and I'm talking 1 April 2016 to the 31st of March, the number of death claims was 1,213, you know, paid by the or reported to the PSSPF, and disability claims 270. As far as injuries on duty and fatalities on duty during the last financial year, this is information that we received from the Compensation Commissioner, because all injuries on duty and fatalities on duty must be reported to the Department of Labour, and they've given us a figure of 5,705 injuries on duty reported to the Compensation Commissioner during the last financial year, and fatalities on duty 14 that were reported. So that's the information. We also, just for information, like Jefferson, we are in the process of entering with a memorandum agreement with the Department of Labour, specifically with the UIF Department, Unemployment Insurance Fund Department, as well as the businesses to the Unemployment Insurance Fund, as well as the Compensation Commissioner, and then obviously, you know, to liaise with one another in terms of any claims of disability, any reporting of fatalities and those kind of things. So CIRA can also collate and have that information on hand.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we find ourselves in a very difficult position as a regulator. And each time that there is this kind of tension between members who play within the private security industry, that's where we find ourselves in the middle of it. Now, I think we have to make it very clear that our mandate is as per the Act. When you go into the Act itself, Section 3 of the Act is quite very clear. You will realize that the scope is quite very huge of regulation, but in the main, majority of the sections in the Act says we must promote. And then when it says we must ensure, that's where it then makes it obligatory on us to ensure that there is compliance with legislation. And that's basically three aspects. The first one is that we must ensure that everyone who plays in this space is legitimate. Secondly, we must comply, ensure that they comply with the law. And then thirdly, we must ensure that they actually are legitimate. So the rest of the other sections say we must promote. So we engage in activities to ensure that kind of promotion and awareness is taking place. And often you find that our mandate actually is misunderstood. We are often misunderstood to be playing the role of the Department of Labor, which we don't actually play, but we do some of the work that the Department of Labor is doing. We are actually misunderstood to be playing the role of the Pension Fund Adjudicator or FSB, and that's not the role that we play. So we constantly find ourselves in a position where we need to be looking at how best to lessen the tensions in the industry. And if you look at the budget that we have for year, Jefferson, we have a budget of just under $250 million rand, which is 246 million, as opposed to 7 billion that the fund is sitting with. I'm not saying that the fund primarily should be, all I'm saying is that we should be looking at if we were to direct regulation, where to actually direct regulation to, we would obviously choose to look at the primary mandate of regulation, which is to ensure that it's effective conduct by providers. So I just wanted to make sure that we all align with the scope of what they have.
Follow up on that issue, Honourable Bailey.
Thanks, Chair. May I please ask just a follow up while we're on CIRA before we move on, because it relates directly to their space. And it's been triggered by what was given in one of the presentations to say that as long as a security company is not deregistered, let me say, the obligations to contribute to the Provident Fund remain in place. That was my understanding. And so I'm just curious, because I'm still hung up on this huge gap of the figures I saw between the number of registered companies and the number who are in compliance or registered with the Provident Fund and active with it. Which is curious because the security figure, the security office figures don't or have much less of a discrepancy. It's half of the registered that are actually with the fund. So clearly the vast majority of the companies that are registered but not compliant with the fund have much fewer employees. And it reminds me of a point that was made in a presentation by CIRA in the last 2 or 3 months, where they mentioned that they had picked up on a trend of private security companies being registered for the sole purpose of applying for tenders. And then when the tenders aren't awarded, the company sort of de facto sort of shuts shop, but legally and on paper they still exist. So have you done an estimation of the extent to which that phenomenon is contributing to those kind of figures we saw, where companies are on the fund's books as needing to comply with their contributions, but for all intents and purposes it's just not going to happen because they weren't set up to be to actually do that. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Director Sira.
Maybe before that, Chair.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I wanted them to actually answer
approached SIRA and we questioned the issue of the compliance, who should issue a letter of compliance between the fund and them? And why are they not challenging the fund to contradict their status of saying the company is in compliance? The main worry was that a new company that was formed, as he was indicating, Mr. Mello was indicating, who wants to participate, could not have registered with the fund because it does not have employees to register. So therefore, he would not have a letter of good standing with the fund. So therefore, it closes him out completely, closes that person out completely. And we said to SIRA, you can't sit down and leave these things happening. You need to intervene. Especially what he is explaining is understandable. He explained to us, we understand. But that part, who should regulate the industry, it's SIRA, not the fund on the other hand. So I wanted him also to clarify that question, why are they not actually dealing with those issues as far as issues of compliance are concerned.
Director of SIRA, thank you, Chairperson. From where we stand, we are the only regulator in the private sector industry. So we are the authority that licenses people to play in that space. So anybody that comes and say that you have the authority to be going for tenders, using your letter of position, I think that was incorrect. So the only letter that we issue should be coming from SIRA. We have taken up the matter with the National Treasurer to say that government department cannot go out coming up with requirements that do not exist in law. And because the only requirement for you to apply for tender is that you have to be registered with SIRA, right? And we issue the certificate, we actually say that you need to be registered. But of course, when you have employees, there is an additional requirement that you need to be registered with the Provident Fund. Now, we cannot enforce issues of whether good standing with the Provident Fund or not, because we don't have that kind of mechanism to verify ourselves. That is why Stefan was saying earlier on that we find it very difficult to effectively have the MOU that we had with them in terms of sharing of information, in terms of boosting the numbers of that are there. So those are some of the challenges that we have. And it's even worse when there are allegations that there is an abuse of power. We can't be part of that. So I think that's where the challenge is.
No, Chairperson. No, I'll still be with Chairperson. To me, I find it to be of serious offense that SIRA will preside over an illegitimate board, which is the board. Because according to all members and whatever, the act says 50-50 of the active role players. Now, what does it mean to see that Jefferson, even only if you are told that some members of the board are not even the players in the field of the industry? Now, then SIRA cannot just simply pull out. It will be like in the taxi industry, for example. In the taxi industry, will actually authorize people when they go to the meeting to say to elect the leaders of their association to say, are you a registered taxi operator here? If not, then you are automatically disqualified. Now, how do you then have such an illegal vote holding so much funds, and which cannot actually then be accountable to or be regulated by any statutory rules of government? It will be totally illegal to me. And that is why then you will have these complaints, particularly raised. But as I said, even in the last meeting, that what kind of incentives do you have in place as SIRA to ensure that black emerging companies actually are sustained? Now, even only if we can simply say, no, we wash our hands, it means SIRA is actually distancing itself from its own statutory requirement, role that it ought to be playing. We are not saying, I don't think that we as a committee are saying that you need to go
to the conceptual area of who gets tenders and what, that is none of your business. But in terms of regulating who are the role players and have any legitimate bodies to be there, it lies squarely on your shoulders. You cannot run away from that.
Process that you can apply for exemption from Section 7A
which the board has done, and we have currently got exemption from Section 7A, so we do not have to have those elections that is recorded in the Act. We look back, we started as early as in the year 2009, if my memory serves me correct, to actually have a look at what is the possibility of having elections in the industry. But one needs to understand that the nature of the security industry, the security officers are spread over this country, literally from one corner of the country to the next, all over. You would have to approach a body like the IAC to have such an election if you wanted to do it properly, and it would literally cost millions and millions of rands to do such an election. And those would be members' money, so one also has to have the interest of members at heart when looking at that. So based on that, that's one of the reasons that the FSB granted us exemption from Section 7A. It's also not an exemption that is continuous. You have to reapply for that exemption on a regular basis, whereby the FSB still looks at the circumstances in the industry. So what is currently happening, and this is also contained in the rules of the fund, is that the industry have what we call a national bargaining forum. That forum is contained out of employer bodies as well as unions that represent the industry. And they are the people that negotiate wages for the wages and conditions and other benefits for the security industry on a 3-yearly basis. Well, it depends whether the agreement is signed for 3 years or not, but so far, in most cases, the agreement lasts for 3 years. So to establish representation on the National Bargaining Forum, what the CCMA does is that registered employer bodies and unions need to submit their registration and proof of registration to the CCMA, as well as proof of membership. The CCMA then, as an independent body, verifies the information that other employer bodies or unions give to them. Based on that, then, seats will be allocated in a national bargaining forum in terms of who is going to negotiate physically for wages, and some people have the ability to sort of sit in, and I'm not quite sure what the word is, but to watch from the sideline, if I can put it like that. So that very same process is contained in the rules of the fund. We use that very same verification process because it is done by the CCMA, which is an independent body, to say, right, which unions and which employer bodies will have representation on the fund. Those employer bodies or unions are then alerted to the fact that they have X amount of seats available on the Board of Trustees. We used to be 24, there used to be 12 employer trustees and 12 member trustees. It became quite problematic to have 12 employer trustees because I can assure you, being
follow up on the response on your body.
Yes, Chair. Seeing that we've got time constraints, can you respond to the question so that we can at least, thanks.
Yeah, the response is just concise. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I think it was just important for me to highlight how the board is structured. So that those employer bodies and unions then elect from their bodies who the people will be that goes on to the Board of Trustees. I just want to mention specifically that the rules of the fund does not allow the director the owner of a security business who has to participate in this fund law. By law, has to participate in the Provident Fund. We don't allow such a person to be a trustee because that's what you're talking about, manipulation and of power and whatever the case might be. So there's no trustee currently on the Board of Trustees that is the owner of a business that must, by law, participate in this fund. We don't allow that. Just in terms of the unallocated contributions, Chair, I can assure you we've already brought down the figure by about 50%. We have weekly meetings currently with the service provider as well as with our national operations manager in terms of feedback. We're also currently using our client liaison offices to go out and get those missing schedules or go and fix up incorrect schedules to be able to allocate those money. So I can assure you that we're working extremely hard to try and bring that figure down. Chair, there was also an issue about Mubunanala and SALT. Yes, Chair, quite correct. When the media reports came out, we immediately scrambled to make sure that our assets were protected. We did do a due diligence on Mubunanala at the time. and we were told certain issues by the new chief executive officers that have taken over, Ms. Angel Ntendwa. Obviously, the previous CSO, as we all know, was deported, and it was found that he was to be illegal in the country, and he was deported. In terms of Mvunangala owning salt, there's two shareholders currently in salt, Chair, and the one is Mr. Eddie Stradel. He owns 49% of salt, and then there's a 51% shareholder from a company, or not from a company, a body called Ntsika, which is supposedly to be a black woman power empowerment body. That company, or shall I say that body in Tsiko, Mr. Mongani Mshlanga or anybody from in that nature was never a shareholder or a director registered with that. What we did find, however, is that two ladies working in the Mvunangala group was also directors of Tsiko. We obviously spoke to Salt immediately. And from what I can understand, there's negotiations going on because Salt said that they were definitely introduced to the body in Tsika by Mr. Mungani Mumshlanga from Mvunangala because they wanted a PEE partner and that was their way out. But from what I understand, they are trying to purchase back that 51% from Tsika, and I'm not quite sure where that is down the line. Chair, but the board is keeping an eye on that and then we're questioning that on a regular basis. So in terms of there was a comment or a question in terms of from Mbela Life, which is the funeral underwriter, Jane, our view...
There's something that he left out.
I'll give you an opportunity to let him first use. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jane. Jane, so the Mbela Life is a legal entity all on its own. It's owned by the Mvunangala Group. Yes, that's definitely so. I am not aware of the fact that Salt has got any shareholding or ownership in terms of a better life. If that is so, I'm definitely not aware of it. In terms of our due diligence process during the procurement process, that certainly wasn't picked up, and that's one of the things we checked as directors and ownership of such a company. So I'm not aware that Salt has got any interest in Propeller whatsoever. Chair, just in terms of the appointment date of Salt, which was 1 September, quite rightly so, that was also the implementation of the new board. The term of the current board came to an end on the 1st of September. There were 7 changes overall in terms of new trustees, but the decision to move from ACA to Salt was certainly taken by the board prior to 1 September 2016, that is so. But to say that there was no changes in terms of the trustee, that is not true. There was a total of 7 changes in terms of trustee that was changed. I just want to mention the effect or the benefit of having a full-time risk officer. Chair, I think it's been a significant help to the Board of Trustees. There is so much legislation and act.
Just a moment. I'm about
yeah, thanks, Chair. I'm sorry. That new board on the 1st of September, was there an AGM or were they just picked up?
Thank you for the question, ma'am. Ma'am, we do not have AGMs. We have board meetings, which we do once a month. The AGMs are held by the different employer bodies and unions. During those AGMs, they will then, like when the new board was established on the 1st of September, once again, the employer bodies and unions were asked to put forward the names, and that would be decided at the AGMs of those bodies. So the Board of Trustees does not have an AGM. We only have board meetings. I hope that answers your question. Just in terms of the risk officer, just to go back to that, Chair, in terms of a monitoring thing and being transparent in terms of what we do, I think it's helped us a great deal. There's a great deal of act and legislation that you have to adhere to as a provident fund, so I think it's added a lot of value for us in our opinion. In terms of financial statements, Chair, we do get audited once a year. Year end is February. From that you obviously have 6 months time to do your audit and then submit it to the FSB. And I'm happy to say that in the last 5 years we've been able to hand in our financials on time. We have not been in the position where we had to ask for an extension. Audited financial statements is available from the FSB website that is published. It is public information. We also hand it out to employers or stakeholders that ask for it.
Jen, the only qualification that we've had on those audits in the last couple of years was in terms of unallocated contributions, because you are only allowed to have 2.5% of your total asset value in unallocated. So that has been a qualification. It's also one of the reasons why we are working so hard on getting rid of that. Jay, then I just want to check on the questions here. I think we've spoken now about how the fund is established. We've spoken about the exemption of Section 7A. Jay, then just I want to come back to the letters of compliance, Jay. Jay, we have two forms of compliance documents, if I can call it that. The one would be a compliance certificate. Compliance certificate is issued to a company that is 100% compliant. In other words, the contribution schedules, everything is received in time and is up to date. Then we have a compliance letter. Jay, as you have heard previously in our presentation, we do enter into acknowledgement of debts with employers that do owe money to the fund. We give those, if they are up to date and with the arrangement in terms of the AOD as well as their current payments, we will issue them with a compliance letter. That compliance letter will state the details of the acknowledgement of debt. It will say this is how much the amount was, it is up to date in terms of payment, and that the current monies are being paid. So we do issue that as well. So then there was a question about the disability and debt reserve account. Yes, Chair, we have such an account. We are self-insured in terms of debt and disability. Currently, that account stands in the region of about, Chair, I think we check that regularly. If I'm not mistaken, last week the figure was around about 694 million. So, Chair, we also have an actuary, a full-time actuary that is a service provider to the fund, which helps us in terms of making sure that we are financially sound in terms of the amount of money that we should be holding in that reserve account. So that the money in that reserve account is separate from the amount of assets that we spoke about earlier in the region of 6 billion. So that's over and above the money that we have invested. So obviously the reason, there are many reasons to be self-insured in a fund of our size. It's obviously much cheaper. If you had to go and buy that benefit out in the marketplace, it would cost you a lot more. Then I just want to comment on the issue of the fact that that certain trustees or that the board as such are issuing letters of compliance at their will. If any such things are happening, I would be glad to receive information on that, and I can assure everybody that I would certainly investigate that. I'm not aware of any such practice. There also, I think there was a comment made that unions and some trustee or employer bodies own companies. I'm also not aware of that, Chair. So once again, if I can have information on that, I would like to have a look at that. Chair, just also, maybe I can just comment on Anesh, our legal consultant. He was not a trustee, or he was a trustee on the fund, but he was our independent trustee. Fortunately, we do have to have on our board an independent trustee. So if we have a situation where the member trustees and the employer trustees come to a deadlock in terms of a decision that needs to be made, the independent will have the swinging vote. At the time, the FSB was concerned that the fact that he was our independent trustee plus our legal consultant could be a conflict of interest, hence the board decided to reappoint, and we've now got Mr. Isaac Raputa, which is the president of the IRFA, as our independent trustee. Chair, I think I've covered most of them.
Yeah, I was a bit early on the LGADT acquisition as well as the TRM. Just to clear the record, we don't buy companies because they're problem funds and they're not compliant. TRM is under business rescue. There's 2,000 people that could lose their jobs, and we stepped into the shoes and we're following the process. ADT is the international bid. Company decided to leave South Africa, and we went through the process.
people on the ground are being abused and not getting the benefits that they should get. And for our company and our organizations, we're saying that's what we stand for and that's what we want to achieve. Thank you.
Right, I'm going to take those two members. There was also the gentleman who wanted to raise one matter. Let's keep the members 10 minutes, then let me finish.
You heard the presentation by Nantos. They raised very unpleasant things about you. For some reason, you are not even in your response, you don't even touch on any of them. It's like they never mentioned them. So my question is, why are you treating them the way you are treating them? Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. In your statement, you raised that the board sees weekly. How much does the board pay the trustees per meeting? And how many committees are serving within the board? And how much have they been paid in the past 6 months? And the issue of less people in your board. You said you didn't go to the AGM or you are not going to the AGM. Are you happy with this board that you are having of white people, not black people? Thank you, Chairperson.
Right, members, I want 1 minute because we don't have time. No,
Chairperson, my name is just quickly to get a response. If you don't call AGM in the constitution of your own board, what criteria are you using to establish that? Because that seems to be the problem, the criteria that you are using, so that we can have the number of things.
Thank you, Honorable Markey, and then Honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to make a request because this matter falls within our jurisdiction as portfolio committee on police and also on labor, portfolio committee on labor. That whatever went on today be related to the portfolio committee on labor, if possible that we have a joint session with labor, with everybody else. Because I think it's very serious and if we are not going to be able to sort it out, we are definitely not going to leave it as it is. We must have a follow up and see how far we can go and where is it going to end. So I would say it must be recorded that we pull in the Department of Labor or the Portfolio Committee on Labor. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you for that proposal. I'm begging you the last.
Thanks, Chair. It's a very short and simple question, but just by way of a quick forward, this is why I was so keen to get clear on the process and the system for arriving at the composition of the Board of Trustees, because I think it's important we stick to the facts and it's important we stick to what the law allows, and I'm very much in agreement with Mr. Chauke that issues of the Provident Fund, the mechanics of it are really not in their hands. That's a Labour Department issue. And there's a whole mess going on over there with the labour inspectorates, just off the farming sector. From what I understood of the explanation given, it seems the key issue here is around TAPSOSA having a seat at the table of the National Bargaining Forum, because that's the platform that leads to the Board of Trustees. If I understood that system correctly, that's the sort of key hinging mechanism. So then the simple question is, what's happening to get TAPSOSA on the NPF? What are the blockages? What are the hindrances? It's a Labour Department issue, so I don't want to get too deep into it, but in contributing to problem solving, can we then make sure that that happens? Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Can I contribute, Chair, on my subject? Yes, sir. Yeah. Chair, I just want to raise this important point. And, you know, it's so very strange that suddenly today, and we raise this issue of procurement within the Provident Fund. It can't be right that the board members don't know who are the owners of something, because it's a chain of single people owning all that. South Africans were never given a fair procurement processes about the procurement of the service providers within the pension fund. Number two, the current legal advisor they have there, their actuaries, their administrators and everything, the posts were never advertised. We don't know about anything, but we have to pay money there. And the people that are not owners of security company want to tell us how things will run our money. And also, who did they apply to or talk to as a security owners company that they must invoke Section 7A with the FSB so that they don't have to hold general annual meetings to elect members of the board. They did that exactly so that they can have a white voice like they have now. Thank you, Chairman.
Can I make closing in on behalf of the organization? The earlier on, I wanted to raise a point when I was presenting, and I said he left out something. This Ntsika Women Empowerment Company, 36 million rand was paid by Mbula Nala in acquiring that stake of 51%. So how can we say there is no relations when they have paid Mbula Nala has paid 36 million rand? The issue of elections, when you say it's expensive, it does not make sense because they do road shows to each and every province. So if they are saying it's expensive to cover up the whole country in doing elections, and they find it very cheap for them to go out and do road shows where they go and lie to people, it's surprising. The issue of the board meetings, we are left informed that they even not even come around the table. They even Skype and call it a board meeting and get paid for that. The issue of compliance that was raised to say, and I think I like the fact that he was trying to be very thoughtful of and mindful of the our people that we employ who are the poorest, and saying compliance is killing. They must come in and tell us, because they are the worst people in terms of declaring employees, because they use brokers as their employers, and they run away with murder. And they don't pay out the dues of the employees because they say these people are not our employees while they're wearing their uniforms. So the whole issue is a company that they use called Ubuntu, which must be investigated and see how it actually assists their employment processes. And Chairman, I should note that we've came here knowing very well that our coming here could have serious damage to our institutions, our companies as we live here. And it's this parliament that will protect us. The little tenders that we have with our government are at serious risk because of these people when we live here, because they've got control over all of them. So I'm trying to say to parliament, this parliament needs to protect us on those areas of problems. Thank you.
Thank you. The last hand there, then I want to close the way forward. Thank you. There was a hand. Yes, sir.
Chair, not specifically related to this discussion, but I think the crux of the issue is indeed whether TEPSOSA has a seat in the National Bargaining Forum. So as a just food for thought, my name is Costa Diabastos. I participate in the National Bargaining Forum, and I'm its nominated representative. So my suggestion to TEPSOSA in that regard would be to request a seat in the National Bargaining Forum. No party has ever been turned away by the forum, and participation in the forum is open to anybody.
Thank you very much, honourable members. Thank you, guests. We come to the end of this hearing. I think we note the concerns of TEPSOSA, and we also note the input from CIRA as well as the duties from the Provident Fund. Most of the issues relate to the Department of Labour, FSB, and Pension Fund adjudicator, and I think the proposal the honourable Martin will take forward that we will have a joint meeting in the fourth quarter. We won't have time in this term to, you know, discuss the issues with Labour, and the record of today's proceedings as well as presentations will be made available to the PC on Labour for further processing. Then I think
Section 7 of the Pension Fund Act is maybe the material thing, the issue of representation. We can't ignore that. That is the elephant in the room. And I think that is maybe an issue that the security industry must go back, and the pension fund, to reflect on, and maybe come with a solution before the meeting we have in the fourth quarter. How can we ensure that the issue of representativity is addressed as a matter of urgency? That's quite critical. I think everybody agrees with regard to that. Then I think also the issue of stakeholder relationship, the Provident Fund must deal with that. And there must be a way to find a solution. We can't have the same industry fighting against each other. So from the portfolio committee side, we're urging those relevant role players to sit around the table and sort the thing out. I think it's not issues that can't be solved. Then we want to just apologize to the Security Alliance as well as to CIRA. We can't proceed with this meeting, unfortunately, but we will communicate the new date in due course. So thank you very much also for being here today and also contributing. Thank you, members. This meeting is closed. We will meet tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock.